Does restricting acetaminophen with opioids reduce acute liver failure?
A new agent to lower cholesterol.
Cardiovascular risk factors among young adults.
And how do we optimize cardiovascular preventive therapies in people that have diabetes?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine and parenthetically recording today from Saigon, Vietnam.
Right. And also our emphasis on cardiovascular disease, of course, in conjunction with the American College of Cardiology meeting. Why don't we turn, Rick, first to the New England Journal of Medicine? This was an agent that we sort of foreshadowed last week we might talk about and with which you're familiar.
This is a new cholesterol-lowering agent called bempedoic acid, and it just completed a study and reported not only its cholesterol-lowering effects, but also the cardiovascular effects. In essence, it's an agent that still targets a pathway that the statins target. Its value may be in individuals that are statin intolerant. That is, about 9% of the population states that they can't take either a statin or the high enough dose of a statin because of muscle aches or pains. The incidence of true myalgias is actually closer to about 1% or 2%. In this particular study, they took people that were statin intolerant. They weren't able to take medium or high doses of statin, and they randomized them to placebo or bempedoic acid, a single dose a day. And then they evaluated what is their LDL cholesterol drop. And the second is, did it have a corresponding drop in major adverse cardiovascular events? And that's four components: death from cardiovascular causes, heart attacks, stroke, or the need for coronary revascularization. And what they discovered is that the addition of bempedoic acid to a statin lowered LDL cholesterol about 21 percentage points more than just placebo. And that correlated to about a 13% lower risk of the major adverse cardiovascular events. That's a composite of all four events. When you look at just mortality, there wasn't a significant difference between those taking bempedoic acid and those taking placebo. But what this shows is for people that really can't take the dose of statins that we want or can't get their LDL cholesterol as low as they want, the addition of bempedoic acid could be an alternative.
You also foreshadowed, I'll remind you, last week that there was also an anti-inflammatory component relative to this medication, and that we talked about how reducing inflammation might be as important as reducing cholesterol.
Right. And at this particular point, because the statins are well established, this is a single study, so I don't think bempedoic acid replaces the statin, but it can be used in conjunction with one. Are there side effects? Yes. It has its own reported side effects, including tendon rupture, increased uric acid levels, which can lead to gout, and also can reduce glomerular filtration rate. That's a kidney function. And by the way, we don't see those with statin use. It can actually enhance the occurrence of muscle symptoms with statins as well. And for those that are taking pravastatin or simvastatin, it actually raises the serum level, so you shouldn't take those two. I think this is very early study, but it adds to the armamentarium of other drugs we have. So keep this on the radar screen, Elizabeth.
Okay, but let's also address this issue of anti-inflammatory aspects of this medicine or others that you're aware of.
There are some modest anti-inflammatory effects. We do see a decrease in C-reactive protein, but whether it has all the pleiotropic effects, is it as potent an anti-inflammatory agent as statin? We don't know because it's not been directly compared to statin. So does it have some anti-inflammatory effects? Yes. Is it as good as statin? We just don't know yet.
Let's turn to JAMA, where we're going to spend the rest of our time this week. And here's something that's of great interest to me because of my work in the MICU. And that's this association of the FDA's mandate limiting acetaminophen in combination with opioid products and what happens with subsequent hospitalizations and acute liver failure. We see a tremendous amount of liver failure, of course, on this unit. So that's why I focused on this one this week. This is an analysis of hospitalization data between 2007 and 2019 from the National Inpatient Sample, a hospitalization database, and it's looking at this combination of acetaminophen and opioid toxicity and acute liver failure involving that particular combination. They identified just shy of 40,000 hospitalizations involving this particular combination. Interestingly to me anyway, 67% about were in women. Their median age was about 42 years. They looked at, well, what was the rate of hospitalizations, the predicted rate, one day prior to the FDA's mandate and then afterward. Previous, it was 12.2 cases per 100,000 hospitalizations, and afterward, it was 4.4. And they calculate that rate at 11% per year after this announcement was made. That was the reduction in acute liver failure hospitalization secondary to the combination. Seems like it's really a pretty effective thing to do. The authors note that acetaminophen, of course, is found in more than 150 over-the-counter preparations for a variety of illnesses and pain, and more than 25 billion acetaminophen doses alone or in combination are sold in the U.S. annually. So it looks like the FDA's mandate to limit the amount of acetaminophen to 325 milligrams per tablet in these combinations with opioids was effective. However, the editorialist notes that this is actually a really modest impact on this rate, and that subsequent to this, we've seen acute liver failure secondary to just acetaminophen alone go up quite a bit.
Right. And the reason why it's a drop in the bucket, Elizabeth, is because more than 52 million people in the U.S. consume acetaminophen on a weekly basis. And many of them really are unaware. There are literally hundreds, and the editorialist says more than 500 over-the-counter products that contain acetaminophen. So many people get it and don't realize it, and they don't realize that the doses that they're ingesting could actually cause liver failure. Acetaminophen toxicity is the leading cause of acute liver failure in the U.S., and close to half of those are unintentional overdoses. So while it's good to limit the acetaminophen dose in the acetaminophen opioid combinations, we still have a lot of work to do because it's still prevalent throughout many other medications, combinations, and over-the-counter medications as well.
I have to just point out that the editorialist says, quote unquote, as you've already cited, half are related to unintentional overdose or what's called therapeutic misadventure. I don't know. I'm not convinced that that's probably a really good term to use. And ultimately concludes that the best solution would be development of safer and more effective analgesics, something that we've been looking for a really long time.
Most of the analgesics have some sort of side effects, whether that be gastrointestinal bleeding or kidney toxicity, or in this particular case, liver failure. But I want our listeners to actually pay attention, because if they're taking an over-the-counter analgesic, look to see if it has acetaminophen. One should make sure that they limit their dose to less than 4 grams a day, preferably less than 2 grams a day.
Right. And we also, of course, have to consider impact as we age and also with polypharmacy.
Absolutely. Concomitant liver disease or kidney disease all increase the risk that one will develop liver failure with acetaminophen ingestion.
Staying in JAMA then, let's turn to coordinated care to optimize cardiovascular preventive therapies for people with type 2 diabetes.
This is based upon the fact that we know that there are some medications that are particularly helpful in people that have diabetes. They're helpful in reducing the cardiovascular risk associated with diabetes. These medications include high-intensity statins, angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors or ACE inhibitors, or their cousins, the angiotensin receptor blockers or ARBs, and more recently, the so-called SGLT2 inhibitors or the GLP-1 receptor agonists. Unfortunately, very few individuals with diabetes are actually prescribed all of them. In this particular study, those that receive usual care, only about 14% were receiving all three medications. How do we increase that? They looked at 43 different U.S. cardiology clinics, and they recruited almost 1,000 to either receive usual care or what they called coordinated care. They looked at clinic-specific analysis to find out what the barriers were to providing these evidence-based medications. They developed local interdisciplinary care pathways to address the barriers. They coordinated care among all the clinicians. They did clinician education. They did audit and feedback of how well they were doing, and finally provide educational materials to the participants. When they actually combined all six of these, it went from about 14.5% to as much as 38% were prescribed all three therapies.
Rick, in your leadership role, of course, I know that you're examining all the time these sorts of strategies that seek to optimize care by engaging many different stakeholders, if you will, or providers or clinicians in this particular effort. What are the barriers to doing it?
As I mentioned, there were six different steps in this coordinated care effort, and any one of those steps could be a barrier.
I guess we're going to be hearing a lot more about this as more evidence emerges that it's an effective approach. Mm-hmm. So let's then continue in JAMA and look at cardiovascular risk factor prevention, treatment, and control in U.S. adults between the ages of 20 and 44 years over the last 11 years. In this study, they took a look at the NHANES database, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. They had just shy of 13,000 U.S. adults in that age group, 20 to 44 years. What they note over this time period is that the prevalence of hypertension increased from 9.3% to just about 12%. The prevalence of diabetes increased from 3% to 4.1%, and obesity from 33% to 41%. The only thing that decreased was the prevalence of hyperlipidemia. Black adults had high rates of hypertension, and that we saw this disparity among different ethnicities, including Mexican Americans, where they were more impacted by these things. And since we know that cardiovascular health and health in general is a lifelong enterprise, what they suggest is that, gosh, we really need to get our arms around this. This is not working out very well and bodes a real problem in cardiovascular disease for sure in upcoming years.
This is just the beginning, because life expectancy in the U.S. is now the lowest it has been since 1996, with young and middle-aged adults seeing the most rapid declines. And in fact, when they look at how heart disease contributes, is that the increase in heart disease just between 2020 and 2021 explains more than 4% of the recent shortcomings in life expectancy.
If you were going to approach this problem, how would you do that?
This group's particularly hard because at that age, you remember, Liz, we felt like we were immortal. We didn't have usually health problems that were symptomatic. Oftentimes, they don't even have insurance, and they certainly don't see a doctor on a regular basis. There's competing priorities between family and work. This is going to take several efforts. It's going to be a population-wide policy changes, health promotions at both the community and the individual level, and we need to promote risk factor prevention and control even at a very young age. Laws and policies that address tobacco control, sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, adequate nutrition, SNAP assistance programs for low-income families. We talked a week or so ago about the importance of family leave. Typically, in my practice, we're talking about prevention when people are 60, 70, 80 years old. We need to begin starting it when they're 20 and 30, 40 years old now.
Sounds like a clear charge in moving forward. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.